Hello, everybody. And today we are joined by Chris Jones, a rugby correspondent for the BBC who co-hosts our rival podcast, Rugby Union Weekly, and is a prominent broadcast journalist across all things rugby. Welcome to the Will Cohen-Hoff Show, Chris. Thank you for coming on. Yeah,
good to be here, guys. How's it going?
All good, thank you. All good. I suppose our first question for you, Chris, is kind of telling us how your journey to where you've got to now and how you got into sports journalism. So if you could just kind of give us an overview of that.
Yeah, for sure. So I studied a degree. I was at University of Nottingham where I did a history and ancient history degree, which was good fun, but like didn't massively prepare me for a life as a sort of sports commentator. But that's kind of the way it is. And then I sort of got a job at the BBC maybe a year or two out of university, just as a temporary job for a couple of months, just covering for someone who was covering for someone on mat leave. So it wasn't going to be anything long term. But then, as is often the case with the BBC, you start for 3 months and suddenly you blink and you're there for 17 years, which I will be as of, well, in the next, I think it's end of March or end of April or something. And then once you're in somewhere, you know, it's that old adage that better to be at the bottom of a ladder you want to climb than halfway at one you don't. And I think that's really, really true. And so once I was in at the BBC, just ended up doing a bit more and probably started doing on-air stuff about my mid-late 20s, doing, you know, a bit of local radio and then doing, you know, commentary probably around that time as well, maybe a bit after. And then was pretty much full-time on the rugby beat about 10, 12 years ago or so. So that's kind of me. And we set up the podcast about 7 years ago as well. So that's been going for a little while as well. So that's my career so far in a bit of a nutshell.
That's brilliant. And I think, what do you think were your biggest hurdles, like starting out, especially in journalism? I think, especially not being a pro yourself, I think in the last few years, loads of pros recently have started to join broadcasting, especially at TNT Sports, for example. What do you think kind of set you apart from other people? What did you have to overcome, particularly to get where you are as you are now?
Well, I suppose I was lucky to go into a department in BBC Radio, which had, you know, long history of people as broadcasters without a professional background, you know, sort of broadcast journalists. So yes, you're dead right. The proliferation of ex-sports people into all kinds of media space has been huge, whether that is the kind of presenting interviewing role, which has previously been the domain for a broadcast journalist. That's now got a load of ex-sports people in that. And of course, they're going to be in the pundit role because, you know, you want from your pundit firsthand experience of being involved in whatever sport they're covering. So I suppose I was lucky that I was going into an environment where there were a lot of broadcasters, you know, we corresponded for pretty much every sport, all of our reporters, you know, every day on a Saturday afternoon on Five Live Sport, there'll be 20 reporters in the field, of which very few of them would have a professional sporting background because they would, like me, have been a broadcast journalist from the early 20s and obviously not had the sporting talent either to be a professional sports person, probably more importantly. So, yeah, I think it's a really valid question. I suppose you want to be able to do certain things that that make you stand out, in whether that's having good knowledge of your sport or whether that's asking the right questions as an interviewer, or whether it's being able to talk succinctly and interestingly about your sport, whatever it might be, because obviously you are making up for the deficit that you haven't played the game. And while I think it's really important to always remember that you haven't played the game and to sort of not let that feel like you know it all, that's really important. But also you are representing the supporters. Professional rugby is a product. It's not much different to people to pay to go to dinner or to the cinema. If you like the product, you'll pay for it. And if you don't, you won't. And I've got a responsibility to sort of represent the view of those people who pay the money and make rugby a professional sport and keeps it viable. So I suppose it's trying to sort of balance all that stuff up.
Yeah, no, very interesting. And I suppose
To follow up on that, do you think it's become harder in recent years for people to break into punditry and sports journalism when they themselves haven't played the game to a high standard, possibly to international level?
Possibly. But on the flip side, I would say it's also never been easier to get yourself published, you know, to get yourself out there in the public domain. You know, when I was coming through, there was no social media, there were no podcasts, you know, what you guys are doing now. You had to wait for an opportunity by, you know, through the local radio, or if you were, you know, it was unlikely to go straight to national radio. So you had to bide your time like that. What you guys have is, while yes, there is this huge proliferation of exports people in the podcast space and other areas of the media, you also have a chance to build up your own portfolio by being self-starters like you're doing now. And that wasn't as easy 20 years ago. So I think there are sort of two sides to it.
Interesting. Okay. And I suppose if we had Flats on last week, which was quite cool. And I suppose the question there was, you know, that age old question of what's the step up like, say, from club rugby to international rugby. If we were to frame this towards you, would you say you had a similar kind of point where you needed to, there was a marked difference between the quality that was expected at one level as opposed to another, say local radio to national radio or something like that?
Possibly, but that all comes with experience, and also you shouldn't be, and this is up the responsibility of editors and program schedulers. No, you shouldn't be thrown into the deep end when you're not comfortable with it. I suppose for me, if I look back, I did bits of stuff on local radio, and the bulk of my broadcasting was broadcasting for local radio, which is still, you know, a huge pressure and responsibility. Then when I started on Five Live, it was probably more doing stuff on the overnights or, you know, very early mornings. And then you work your way up to, and then you maybe would do something in the 6 o'clock hour, which wouldn't be well, that would still be a very important hour, but it wouldn't be the main focus of the show compared to the 7 hour or the 8 hour, say, on a breakfast show. So it has to be a gradual process. And same goes for commentary. You would start doing online commentaries, and then you might do Sports Extra commentaries, and it'd be a while before you would do Five Live commentaries, and then even longer before you do a Five Live international commentary, then longer before you do a Five Live international World Cup final commentary. So you should, and this probably applies to rugby players, although you might get a situation where someone's a hot shot at 18, or like some of the Welsh guys now played 10 pro games and suddenly they're playing international. Perhaps the journey can be a little bit less linear. And maybe these days, with the way the media is, and there isn't that kind of local radio pathway like there was, because sadly that there isn't the same resource in local radio, people probably do find themselves at times perhaps a bit overexposed too quickly. But it's very hard for you to say, oh, I don't want to do that, I'm not ready. But as long as you feel like you've got enough miles on the clock to be able to take that next leap, then you'll be able to really take it on, do it to the best of your ability, and know that you've not done it before you're ready.
Brilliant.
I think also, because you've mainly focused on broadcasting, is there a particular reason why you wanted to do that over possibly print journalism? For example, I don't know, writing articles for any of like the Sunday Times, Telegraph, or any of the other news outlets?
Well, I mean, I think it's you don't really get the choice, do you, when you start off? I mean, I know everyone at 20, you know, in their mid-early 20s, they would, you know, like to pick what they do, but as you guys would know, it's not that straightforward. You've got to see where the opportunities are. And I got an opportunity at the BBC, and got an opportunity in radio production, and they got an opportunity in radio broadcasting. And yeah, while I do a bit of stuff for the BBC Sport website, yeah, as you say, my main trade is broadcasting. And I just, that would, the advice I would give is have an idea of what you maybe want to do when you're 40, but don't at 25 think, oh, I want to be a broadcaster, I'm not going to write, or I want to be a writer, I'm not going to broadcast. You need to be doing everything. All of it is absolutely crucial to your development and experience. So to answer your question, if I'd got an internship at the Sunday Times, I could be on a very different path, but I'd probably be enjoying it just as much. It just is kind of where it went. And, you know, it turns out I really, really love what I do, which is lucky. But you don't really get the luxury of choosing necessarily, do you, when you start off?
And you've mentioned that in your role now, you kind of want to make sure that you represent the view of the fans, etc. Would you say that becomes particularly important, especially in your role with the BBC, where I suppose you're encouraged to be maybe more balanced and neutral now that social media has obviously kind of not taken over the game, but it's obviously becoming so much more important in the game. People have so much more extreme viewpoints, I suppose, within rugby to try and, you know, grab views and big headlines. Would you say that your role is probably even more important now than it maybe was, a role like yours was 10, 15 years ago, would you say?
Maybe. I think that, yeah, the key thing is like, as a journalist, I suppose we've got to see ourselves as supporters, but who have the privilege to, you know, speak to the players and speak to the coaches, to interview them, to get a picture of what they're doing, perhaps to be privy to some information that the average fan might not get. So you're also speaking, you know, you might speak to, you know, one person who thinks that that team is great, one person doesn't think they're great, one person that really rates that coach. And then you kind of almost have to filter all the information you get and then filter it out into a version that is as balanced and as fair. You're never going to represent the view of every fan. Of course you're not. Like, if you speak to 10 people leaving Twickenham, they'll all have a different take on the game. I suppose what you've got to do is go, look, this is what that team is trying to do. That's why they've made this selection. You then have your, leave it to the fans to decide whether they like it or not. But you just got to, I suppose, give them the information. You know, if you interview a head coach and the head coach says, I've picked X or Y because of this, 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 then you can't turn around to the fans and go, I've got no idea why he's picked him. You've got to go, well, you know, this is the explanation. And then leave it to people to decide. You can't tell people what to think. You give people the information and then they decide. But ultimately, and this is where, you know, for coaches and fans, it's probably what's quite hard for them to take. But equally, it's probably quite hard for politicians or musicians or athletes or artists to take when they work for 200 hours on a film and someone watches it at a cinema and goes, no, that's crap, not for me. They'll go, oh, look, but all that was hard work. And so you often get players turning around and going, oh, we've never worked, we're working so hard. But unfortunately, being in professional sport where you are trying to sell a product, everyone's got the right to watch the 80 minutes and go, look, you can talk all you like, I didn't think that was a very good performance, or I didn't think it was a very good game. That is in everybody's right, because if they're consuming it, the same way as if you're buying a meal or watching a film, you have the right to judge it how you see fit.
I think also following up on that, how do you see social media? Do you think it's a very positive thing for possibly journalists, fans, but maybe not so for players, because they're under increased scrutiny? I think possibly nowadays a lot more than even 10, 15, 20 years ago.
It's really complicated. It's such a good question, but it's so complicated, because if you asked every player, would you want to get rid of social media, they'd probably say yes, but there'd also be some that make a lot of money from endorsements, so they peddle through social media. So you've got to be careful what you wish for. And the same goes to journalists who might bemoan Twitter, but then always publish their articles there because they like the publicity that comes with Twitter. The problem, I think, is you get people on Twitter who are really, really influential, maybe like sort of an account that might be really influential, but not massively informed. And I've not got a problem with that when it comes to opinion, but I do have a problem when it comes to fact. If someone tweets something that is factually incorrect, or where people don't show the right respect. You know, I saw someone was tweeting today about a selection Stuart Barnes made in the paper and mocking the selection. I'm a bit like, well, A, that's Stuart Barnes, so have some respect. And B, he's been consistent in his view that Ben Earl should play 12 for ages. And C, it's something that really senior figures in the England setup have talked about potentially doing. So it's not just a pie in the sky. And too often think people are looking to mock, belittle, take the piss to get some traction. And that's the part of it I don't particularly like. But, you know, the discourse, we can't have it both ways. We can't say we love the Six Nations because there's such great discourse and the fans are going at each other and there's so much noise. You know, that's what the Premier League has every day, noise, noise, noise. We often say we want that in rugby, but we can't then say, oh, we want it to all be really nice and really, you know, really soft and no one actually having to go at each other. So it's definitely a fine line. I think on the whole, it's here to stay. I think there are some apps that I think are great, and I think there's some apps that I think are terrible, and I think there are some accounts that are great and some accounts that are terrible. So to answer your question, and I think there are players who have benefited from social media and some have had a horrible time at the hands of it. So it's kind of, but then everyone has the choice. You don't have to have a social media account. You don't have to go on it. You know, everyone has that choice. And if you don't like what's on social media, you don't have to go on it, and you can go back to being normal and have a conversation in the pub with your mates about rugby rather than arguing with strangers on the internet.
And I suppose this linked into what you've kind of just said there, but would you say, since you've been reporting on the game, has there over the last 5-10 years been a shift in how, in the nature of reporting on it? Has everything become a bit more partisan? Or would you say those trends maybe aren't as maybe pertinent as one would think?
It's a really good question. I think this is where, like, and obviously I'm going to stick up for the mainstream media, but the mainstream media, like, we have checks and balances, and we have certain standards we've got to hit, and we've got editors and producers and sub-editors and people checking your copy. Now, that doesn't happen on social media. So there is a, you know, there is traction to be had from being super partisan and from feeding your fan base. And people would say, oh, well, that's what the mainstream media do. And there might be an element of that when it comes to politics, but I don't think there really is when it comes to sport. So I think on the whole, say if you look at the English rugby media, I think it's a pretty balanced bunch. It's not particularly partisan at all. Some would say that it should be more supportive of the team. Others would say it should be less. It's an opinion thing. There'll be some fans who go, look, the media needs to get behind the team at all times. And others will go, hold on, I'm paying 170 quid for this ticket. Don't tell me something's blue when it's green. So again, it's a funny one, because I think people will come at it from different ways.
Yeah. And I think going back almost to social media point, do you think there's possibly a disconnect between Six Nation fans and club rugby fans, especially with the ability for, like, someone on social media to criticise Stuart Barnes for his point? Do you think people who necessarily don't watch club rugby on a weekly basis, when they come to watch Six Nations, they're like, why is this happening? Why is X being chosen over Y, for example?
100%. And I think that's what makes the job of, say, the England head coach really hard, because you're going to have a crowd at Twickenham that would have all different levels of knowledge. And there'll be a crowd at Twickenham that would say, that guy's got to play, and the next person in the next team would say, no, that guy's got to play, and everyone's going to have a different opinion. So you've got to be really kind of, clear as the England head coach about what you want from your team and who you want to pick, and then also try and communicate it the best way possible through the media or through in-house media to make sure people understand why you've picked it. It's, you know, you look at what South Africa do, and Razi Erasmus often does Instagram lives, like, talking to the fans and going, oh, I know you don't want Faf pick. Yeah, before 2019 semi-final, he was going, I know you don't want Faf pick, but have faith in him, kind of thing. An England head coach would never dream of doing that, but that's part of South Africa's, part of their magic is how connected the fans feel to their team, almost sort of slightly intangibly, like, you know, almost sort of spiritually connected to their team. And it's probably a major part of the Springbok success. So there's definitely ways of doing it, ways of interacting with the fans, and every head coach is going to do it differently. But I think you're right. I think come Six Nations time, you will get fans who maybe only watch 5 games a year. However, they still have a right to voice their opinion. There's an enormous corporate market at Twickenham that feeds English rugby to the tune of whatever, 15 million quid a game, and 85% of Twickenham revenues. Often those would be casual Six Nations fans. So again, you come back to be careful what you wish for. If you want to have Twickenham just full of diehards who want to pay 50 quid, then the whole model of English rugby has to change forever. And are people ready for that? And perhaps for a game struggling financially to accept that the finances coming to the game are going to be at 50% because the ticket prices are 50% and the corporate is less because England want a better atmosphere. That's not going to happen in this current economic climate. So anyone saying, oh, we want a different Twickenham atmosphere, would have to be pretty consistent to that and not go on the corporate gravy train and bite the hand that feeds. So, yeah, I know I answered a lot of your questions going, it's quite difficult. And I know it sounds a little bit like I'm sitting on the fence. I just think that there is a huge gap between Six Nations and club rugby. Everyone wants to try and narrow that gap in terms of fan engagement. Mm-hmm. But as it stands, those fans who do turn up 5, 6, 7 games a year often do actually drive the finances of the game, whether we like it or not.
And I suppose the current problems, particularly English rugby, but I suppose world rugby too, faces, you know, with regard to, I suppose, in England, you know, the unfortunate scenario of clubs going under last season, 3 clubs going under last season. And then I suppose the main issue facing rugby as a sport, with concussion and protocols and, you know, changing rules, etc. We'd like to get your take on a few, I suppose, of the solutions or changes that have been widely circulated over the last few years. So starting off with the global calendar and this idea, you know, we have more Northern Hemisphere versus Southern Hemisphere club games and everything's just a bit easier. What would you make of that? Or do you think we're a long way off of that still?
Well, what was decided in the end of 2023 about the Nations Championship, that is the closest we'll get to a global calendar. We're never going to get a complete global calendar because of the hemisphere differences when it comes to weather, unless the Southern Hemisphere want to play in the summer or the Northern Hemisphere want to play in the summer, like rugby league up here, that's not going to happen. There was a move to do that in 2020, but the club game up here weren't ready to move to summer rugby and forego their Christmas income and stuff like that. So in terms of the global calendar, I think what we'll get is as good as we might ever get. In terms of, look, rugby, as you say, Paul, is just dancing this tightrope between trying to embrace what it is and the issues with concussion and brain damage going forward. And for me, I think for rugby, and also rugby's got a problem in that it's so super physical, you can't actually run the Six Nations 5 weeks in a row, which everyone would agree would be better for the Six Nations not to have these fallow weeks, but you can't because the game's too physical. So on the one hand, commercially, it'd be better for there to be more rugby with fewer gaps. Safety-wise, they're trying to have as much gaps between games as possible. But the more gaps you leave, the more that the game will become super, will maintain its super physicality. I think what you have to do is try and change the complexion of rugby completely and make the players that little bit smaller, a little bit more mobile, a bit like what women's rugby is, tiny bit more space on the pitch, and just try and recalibrate away from it being a collision sport to an evasion sport. If you do that, it might help with some of the problems over physicality. It might allow players to play a little bit more rugby, which would help with the commercial reach of the game. Because at the moment, we're kind of, on the one hand, trying to leave loads of gaps, but that will also cost clubs and unions financially. It's a 10-team league with no rugby being played during the Six Nations, and there's no money going into club rugby's gates at the moment, even though we agree it's probably not best to have the club game clashing with the international. So long and short of it, there aren't enough weekends in the year at the moment for everyone to be happy. And unless you somehow find a way, I think, of making the game less physical so players can play more, that's the only way that there might be a sustainable solution.
Right. And obviously, I know it wouldn't. We know that, say, having central contracts, this other idea that they're trying to introduce potentially with the RFU, with these new hybrid deals that they're giving to some players, I know obviously that wouldn't, say, get rid of the need for fallow contracts in the Six Nations, but do you think that would be a good step in terms of managing the star assets of the game a bit better? Do you think that's a good model to follow?
It would, but then if you look at the Irish model, how little those guys play in the URC. Now, they're still able to top the URC Leinster with their second, third team, but they're a one-off, you know, with their conveyor belt of rugby talent coming through the schools and the way they can concentrate it all in Dublin. They're a bit of a one-off. If you were to centrally contract all the England top players, they would probably barely play for their clubs, and the clubs need their best players playing. Mm-hmm. And I think we all agree that Premiership rugby is a great product, which needs to be it needs to be improved and constantly nourished by the top players playing. What they're going to do out of next year is kind of have a situation where Steve Borthwick will have a bit more control over players, if not when they play, but over their S&C and their load management. And I think it would just give him a better idea of which players are ready to be selected when they come into international camp. Because at the moment, it constantly feels as if England players get into camp, they do their bits and pieces, they have a couple of training sessions, he picks a team, someone's injured, someone comes back from injury, team changes, no continuity, no cohesion, and England will go through this trap year on year on year unless they somehow find a way of being able to hit the ground running a bit better in their international blocks. And I'm absolutely sure that's what Steve Borthwick would love to happen, whether it's a full-on central contract or not. He just needs a way of England not having big campaigns like this one and ending it almost with more questions than they got answers.
I think also, like, on that point, do you think possibly international rugby for England, for example, should be put as more important than club rugby? Or is it quite a hard balance in terms of you need people playing in, week out in the Premiership, but then suddenly when it comes to international stage, do players need to be protected and valued as assets more so by England rugby than club rugby, for example?
Yeah, it's a really good point, because if you're a club and there's this bit of a row between Scotland and the Premiership, because Gregor Townsend was like, oh, why are the Premiership keeping our players in fallow weeks when there aren't any Premiership games? However, if you're Finn Russell and you're Bath and you're paying Finn Russell £1 million a year, you do have a right as the employer to be like, in this week, we want you to do a load of commercial work or marketing work, or come in and run drills with our youngsters, or come in and help work on our game plan. You can't just say to Scotland, here you go, have Finn all Six Nations for 2 months and not pay him a penny outside his SIU match fee. Like, it doesn't work like that in any other walk of life. Any other walk of life, no one could come to your employer and can have them for 2 months. Now, you'll have to compensate the employer. The RFU compensate the clubs to have them in international blocks. The SIU have no agreement with Bath. So I really like Gregor Townsend. He's great, but he's not got a leg to stand on here unless they want to start paying Bath money, and the Premiership aren't going to do that out, you know, and have this kind of ad hoc payment structure. We've had it with Wales and George North and Northampton years ago, and the Premiership have every right to say, look, now Bath could do a real solid to Finn Russell and go, look, just come in for a couple of days, help out here, we'll let you go to Scotland on Thursday. And I'm sure there's some kind of compromise being met, but the SIU have no right to keep Russell for all that time. So you're right, the key word is kind of assets, and however hard the RFU and the Premiership try to get on the same page, while the contract is being paid by the Premiership, they will understandably always feel they've got a right to keep the player when they're allowed. So this new model isn't going to change that. What it will do is mean that about $150,000 of a salary is paid by the RFU. So it'll probably just make the clubs that little bit more comfortable if the RFU, if they feel a player is targeting international rugby at the moment, they'd go, well, you know, you can't give everything to England when we're the one paying your wages. So if you can find a way of it being a little bit more of a financial compromise, that might help. It won't go the full way of the Irish model, but if it does go the full way, then we'll have the problem of the club game perhaps suffering.
And sticking on the finances, obviously there are those rumours, probable rumours about potential Saudi investment into the Falcons. Do you think rugby's going to go down now a similar path to what football's gone down, and potentially to a greater extent too? Because obviously, even before Saudi investment in football, I suppose if you could put a date on whenever it was, you can't really do that. But football was already a profitable enough game, so to speak, a marketable enough product. Rugby obviously doesn't have that at the minute. Could the Saudi influence? I know it's all hypothetical, but could the Saudi influence in rugby potentially mirror that of football, do you think? Or do you?
Well, mate, like 100, it's. But why have the Saudis come into football? Or why have, say, a Newcastle gone with the Saudis? Well, because, you know, America had made their move on like Liverpool, Russia on Chelsea, Abu Dhabi on Man City. So the traditional, I don't know, way of running and owning a football club, local businessman done good, just doesn't cut it when you're up against billion pound machines like Abramovich or Sheikh Mansour. So that's where Saudi come along, Newcastle like, well, okay, we're going to go there. And from a rugby point of view, there, of course, will be the conversations about human rights and the Saudis' track record in that space, and understandably so. But the Newcastle attitude would be, well, the other option is this club folds, because the traditional rugby heartlands are kind of capped out financially. You know, New Zealand, South Africa, Australia, Wales, Ireland, Scotland, England. There is just not an abundance of cash. It's somewhere there's not a sponsor out there that is desperate to pour £200 million into rugby. It's not there. If it was there, it would have come out by now. So Newcastle are hanging on by their fingertips at the moment. They're offloading players mid-season. They're trying to get by on a tiny budget comparatively to the rest. And if the Saudis come in and say, look, let's make Newcastle a sporting city and tie up the Falcons and Newcastle United, they're probably going to go for it. And their fans, and they might have elements of their fan base that would complain, and understandably so, and whatever, everyone will have their views on that. But Newcastle United, their football supporters, you know, they want their club to thrive first and foremost. Whether that is right or wrong, that was their attitude. There might have been some Newcastle United fans who have stopped going, but the majority are still flooding into the Gallagher end and going, all right, isn't it great to be back competing in the Champions League? And I think if you gave the same situation to rugby fans, maybe they would object morally, but there'll be a lot of them that would go, well, I probably would, you know, would rather my club existed than not. And that same, you know, you can live golf, look at it's whether you like it or not, it is here, it is kind of here to stay. And the moment one sport makes its move, you can definitely see other sports following.
I think you mentioned the cash injection. There isn't really a massive pool to actually inject into rugby union. What do you think could be a proactive way of making it a more attractive sport and a greater asset without just pure cash, basically?
Oh, God. I mean, look, it's difficult because you could argue that the product on the pitch is pretty good. Like, it's been as good as it ever has. You know, that quarterfinal weekend in the World Cup, like, you're not going to find rugby like that at any other time in the sport's history. I sometimes think rugby spends a lot of its time kicking itself, and sometimes it's so focused on trying to appeal to a new audience, it forgets its existing audience. And rugby's a sport that you kind of get into through your friends and through your family at a reasonably early age. I don't know many people who pick up rugby at 25. Now, you might pick up basketball or UFC or something at 25. I don't know many people who pick up rugby. It's a bit like, do you pick up cricket at 25? And maybe the 100 will help with that. But on the whole, I think you either in it, you either like it or you don't. And maybe that attitude is what's hurting, because the sports are struggling financially with its existing market. But I think the sport has to be just as careful about not alienating its existing core as, you know, it's got to be careful about that as much as they're desperate to bring in new fans as well.
Amazing. And final question before we get on to the very quick fire questions. Time of recording, we've had the first three rounds of the Six Nations. What would you say, if I could only let you have two or three, what would be your biggest takeaways from those first 3 weeks of the Six Nations?
Well, I think I didn't see France bombing like they have. I don't know if many people did. That's a massive shame, because you think now, is that going to be the start of the end of this kind of French Revolution? They were on this mission to win the World Cup. It didn't happen. How much did that quarterfinal exit hit them? And has it kind of damaged that whole feel-good factor in French rugby? Everyone was thriving. The great tie-up between the federation and the clubs. So I really hope they can pick it back up. I hope England and Wales can get it together by the end of the championship, at least show that they mean business. Because otherwise, you're looking at a situation where there are kind of like four average teams in there. Mm. So my hope would be that come the end, we're not just going kind of Ireland, then Scotland, then the rest. You'd love Scotland to continue to improve, England to pull up, you know, England or Wales to pull out a big result, whether against, you know, probably against France in both their cases. And you'd love Italy to win a game as well, to prove that they're not just making up the numbers. So I've enjoyed it. I think there's been unfortunately, some of the teams haven't been great. And maybe by, you know, end of middle of March, we'll have a few more teams meaning business.
Perfect. Thank you very much. So on to quick fire questions then. Paul, shall I start? Earliest rugby memory.
Okay, earliest rugby memory, I think, I was born in 85. I remember when England lost to Wales in Cardiff in 93, so I'd have been eight. But I think before that, South Africa had beaten England at Twickenham, and Juice van der Westhuizen and went down the blind side, and I chipped over the top and scored maybe like 91, 92 kind of time. I don't quite remember the 91 World Cup. I think kind of 1992, age seven, there are a few things that are kind of like in their head. I need to check that Van der Westhuizen try and when it was, because I tried to replicate it at mini rugby the next day.
All right. Now, talking about mini rugby, I know you said on your own pod that you used to be a nine, hence the nine in the Twitter handle and the Instagram page. Who would be your dream 10 to have outside you?
Okay, so I think an underrated 10,
yeah,
was maybe probably before your lad's time, but there was a guy who played for New Zealand bit before Dan Carter and Carlos Spencer called Andrew Mertens, who I've done a bit of work with. And in the 95 World Cup, he was unbelievable. And he doesn't probably get the credit he deserves because obviously like Carter's the greatest. Mm-hmm. But I would say that at that period in the 95 World Cup, Andrew Mertens was one of the best 10s I've ever seen.
Nice.
Cool. So current favourite player?
Current favourite player? Wicked question. maybe Damien Penno. And I'm trying to think if there's anyone else. I feel like there were a few but have retired now. You know, I loved Gavin Henson. Like he was Juan Martin Hernandez, kind of similar, you know, players. In fact, they only won like 30 odd caps, but could have won way more, but had like moments where they were just unplayable. So those two from like my earlier memories, then I think someone like Damien Penn, I'm a big, big fan of now.
Nice. Favorite sport other than rugby?
Cricket. Cricket. And I think cricket is. Your cricket, it's difficult because like I don't, I cover like club rugby. I watch a lot more club rugby. I don't watch loads of county cricket, but international cricket, I think, especially top level international cricket. And I think my earliest sporting memories are still cricket, probably 50-50 head to head with rugby. So rugby and cricket be really tied for first.
So you mentioned club rugby. Favorite club if you had to play for one?
Genuinely, this is gonna. I'm gonna sound like I'm lying, but I genuinely don't support any team. I think if I was to play for one, you'd want to play for one that was like had a massive fan base, big crowd, quite an iconic history. So I'd probably go for somewhere like Bath if you were playing for one. Nice. You'd be a bit of a hero around the town as well, wouldn't you? There's no football here. So I think I'd probably go for Bath.
Speaking of Bath, as I said last week, we had Flats on. Now we asked Flats a bit off the cuff, but who was one player he would not want to get in a scrap with? Now we want your take on that. One current player you couldn't get in a scrap with in a game, or you wouldn't want to.
Oh God, I mean, it's like
and you can't say Danny Kerr.
No. It's like, it's so, when you go and interview these blokes, you're just like, God, they are absolutely huge. I would probably say, I don't know. He's such a nice guy. So maybe not someone like Manu Tuilagi because he's such a friendly bloke, but maybe one of the two, maybe Tuilagi's nephew, the guy playing for France. For solo to a laggy, maybe.
So, best player in the world currently?
I mean, you'd still say Dupont, even though he's playing sevens. And who would rival him? Then it's probably Ardie Savea. Nice. I think Ardie Savea, when all is said and done, and I can't believe he threw that offload at the end of the World Cup final. That's like I you know, when he's going down right in the final play.
Yeah.
I just can't believe he didn't keep hold of that ball. But apart from that, I think Ardie Savea is one of the best I've ever seen.
Nice. Okay. If you could play for one international side that you don't have ties to, who would it be?
Oof. So I've ties to England and Wales.
Okay.
After that, I think you would want to play for Fiji, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Because if you could play nine for Fiji. I just link the play up, you know, and maybe just go on those little lines, like, you know, following on the shoulder of like all of their ridiculous runners. So yeah, probably go Fiji.
Nice.
Favorite pundit. The best pundit I think at the moment is Sam Warburton because he speaks really well. He's really engaging. He's won all the medals. And he's really kind of to work with. He's really generous on air. Like, you know, he listens to your opinion. He asks questions back. He's not one of those pundits who thinks he knows it all and doesn't have anything to hear. So, yeah, he'd be my pick.
Good answer. Favourite coach of all time?
Favourite coach of all time? Mm-hmm. Favourite coach? Good question. Okay, who have we got? Favourite coach? I'm not that had that much to do with him, but by all accounts, one of the best coaches ever was Wayne Smith. And he won with the Red Rose, he won with the Black Ferns, beating the Red Roses. Yeah. Did an interview with him and the Lions in 17 before his last game as an All Blacks coach. I work a lot with and good friends with Paul Grayson and Matt Dawson, who were both coached by him at Northampton, and just think he's a legend. So he's probably the coach who I've heard the most good things about. So I'd say Wayne Smith.
Amazing.
Cool. Favourite ground to commentate at?
Favourite ground to commentate at is, well, actually probably Twickenham. Like the position is amazing. The position is amazing. Cardiff, you're too high up. It's still amazing, but you're a bit higher up. And then a lot of the club grounds are quite, you know, you've got a big pillar in front of you at Leicester. You know, some of them you're a bit sort of further towards the 10 metre or the 22. So, but favourite to commentate at would still probably be Twickenham.
Nice. Down to the final two. Favourite game you've commentated on?
The favourite game I've commentated on is, and I don't think anything's topped it since, even though I've done two World Cup finals since, I still think the best was England 38, Scotland 38 in 2019.
Yeah.
Which was, I just loved it. Just such a great game. So much fun. So much fun.
All right, cool. And final question, if you weren't a broadcaster, what would you be?
Potentially a teacher, just because my mum always thought I'd be a teacher. And my little brother's a teacher.
What subject?
So, yeah. Oh, I don't know. You can kind of get away with not really doing one, can't you? Like, teach a bit of everything. I don't really know. My little brother's a teacher. I don't really know whether he has a subject. So he just kind of knocks around the school, does some games, you know, lots of teas and coffees, and works really hard, don't get me wrong. But like a form master or whatever. No, I think maybe like a bit of history. I can't do languages or maths. Probably a bit of history or English. And then like, yeah, games and stuff like that, trips.
Nice. Well, that rounds us off. Thank you very much for joining us, Chris. It's been absolutely brilliant. And
pleasure.
We do appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Nice to chat. I'll look forward to coming back on if you have me.
Oh, thank you. We'd love that.
Okay.
Hello, Flo. Welcome back to this another episode of the Wilco and Hoff Show.
Hello, Paul. How are you doing?
Yeah, all good. That was a great interview. Another great one, wasn't it?
Yeah, wonderful. I think it was really quite good having a different perspective on the world of rugby, especially because, as I say, we had Flats first week, ex-pro, and Chris Jones, of course, wasn't really a pro rugby player at all, but got into broadcasting for his own efforts, for his own love of rugby as a sport in general. And it was really, really quite interesting to see the different aspects, different perspectives of rugby. Don't you agree?
Completely. I mean, quite a few takeaways from that, I thought. I mean, I think it's really interesting, this, I suppose, dilemma that rugby faces at the minute between, you know, wanting to grow the game and make it a better product for people across the globe whilst still trying to keep that traditional sense of rugby, which is why so many people love it. And yeah, kind of as he mentioned, you know, this idea that some of the rugby being played at the minute is absolutely brilliant, internationally and then also at a premiership level, but you're still not getting those sponsorship opportunities that you might typically see. Well, obviously you would see with football and maybe the cricket with the 100 and competitions like that. Haven't really seen that replicated in rugby at the minute, so it'll be really interesting to see how that Saudi potential Saudi investment into the Newcastle Falcons goes.
So how do you feel about Quinns, for example, being taken over, well, having investment with the Saudis as well, or any other major stakeholders? How do you feel about that?
Well, I feel like it's kind of what Chris Jones was saying. It's one of those where I think it's inevitable, whether you like it or not. You look at football and the influence that obviously foreign owners have had, on the Premier League for a few decades now, and that's a game where, you know, you've got a lot of money already in it. Say even before the Saudi takeover of Newcastle Football Club, rugby obviously not comparable, the amount of money in the game to what there is in football. So do I think it's likely that there's going to be increasing investment from abroad? Yes. And I suppose it'll be interesting to see how rugby deals with that.
Yeah, totally agree. I think one of the other big takeaways from the interview with him was, how do you manage the casual rugby fan, the corporate rugby fan who goes to Twickenham, to Principality, to Murrayfield? How do you align that with almost your die-hard club rugby who turns out to watch the Premiership when it's sleeting, snowing, absolutely pouring down with rain? How do you keep like that person engaged just as much as somebody just turns up to Six Nations, watches a live game of rugby 2 times a year? And I think one of the big impacts he said was like the impact of social media, people criticising, especially Steve Borthwick. People might not necessarily know too much about how players are actually performing week in, week out in the Premiership. How do you manage their expectations alongside so many different almost tiers of rugby fan?
Yeah, no, that's a good point as well. And it does come back to that point of how do you, as I started off by saying, how do you grow the game? Quite a difficult question for rugby to answer at the minute, because obviously it's something that they want to do. What direction do they take it in? Do you keep rugby in the hands of, I suppose, the few nations that have always kind of dominated the game, so to speak? Or you're trying to open it up to new parts of the world, and I think you've got to be adaptable to how you're going to do that. But no, another great interview. Very excited for our guest next week, who we've got to sort out. But we will endeavour to do that this week.
It's in the works, isn't it?
In the works, yeah. We'll leave it like that. I suppose now moving on, what do we want to look at next? A little team of the tournament so far in the Six Nations?
Yeah, I agree.
All right, so you fire away. I think we've got a few points of difference here, don't we? Unless you've nicked some of my suggestions, which you've inevitably done.
All right, so for the pack, you start off the pack?
Yeah, obviously.
So one, Andrew Porter,
right. Yeah. Yeah, speed it up.
Two, Dan Sheehan.
Yeah.
Three, Uni Antonio. Four, Joe McCarthy.
Yeah.
Five, Ty Byrne.
Yeah.
Six, for Doris. Okay. Seven, Tommy Raphael. And eight, Anne Wainwright.
Yeah, I don't think there can be many issues with that. Obviously, Ireland dominate. And then Wales, as you say, Raphael and Wainwright have been brilliant. Doris, obviously, he's world class, probably the best in his position. I suppose you're playing Doris as a six, aren't you, to make room for Wainwright. Yeah. I think Doris probably is at the minute the best eight in the world. I think Alex Mann, though.
Yeah.
You know, only played 3 internationals, and I just think he's been absolutely brilliant for Wales. I think he's been a right find alongside Raphael and Wainwright, and I think that gives Wales something really exciting to look forward to in the future. Moving on to the backs, I've gone for Gibson Park. This is very Irish dominated. Gibson Park, Jack Crowley, Van der Merwe. To try and balance out my Irish bias, I've gone for Melanchello of Italy.
Yeah,
lovely
yeah.
surname. Henshaw, James Lowe, and Cameron Winnett. I think Melanchello for Italy has been playing some really brilliant rugby. Very easy to go unnoticed, I think. Some of these Italian players that are really starting to step up and actually just make the championship more exciting, obviously, almost getting that victory away to France. You know, they've pushed England close. They were battered by Ireland, but Ireland seem to be in a different league within the Six Nations at the minute. You have any changes on those?
Yeah, so I went for Russell at 10. Bundiaki at 12.
Yeah.
Hugh Jones, 13. And a little bit of a rogue choice on the wing for me, Monti Ioane.
He's been playing all right stuff, but I think Super Lewis Lyon is going to replace him.
I think on that note, do you want to say anything about Lewis Lyon?
Just, you know, obviously news came out a few weeks ago, suppose quite an abrupt ending to his Quinn's career, but you would be surprised if you don't see him back at Quinn's at some point.
Do you think he'll make it into this Italian side, even at the end of the Six Nations?
I think he's definitely got a good chance. I don't know if the, you know, if this kind of current Six Nations campaign will come a bit too quickly for him, considering it will probably be a step up from the rugby that he's played before. But I just think it's really interesting, isn't it? It kind of shows where the game's at, that you've got Liner, who every time he plays for Quinns, he never seems to have a bad game, quite often gets on the score sheet, but he's, you know, he's, what are you smiling for? Is it because I said score sheet, you absolute muppet? You know, he doesn't too often make the Quinn starting team anymore. So he's taken the chance, gone to Benetton, who was second in the URC. Yeah.
And I don't know if you've seen their like starting lineup and so on, but it's very Italian dominated. Mm. Quite a few 20, 21, 22 year olds. I think that's going to set them up so well, especially for next World Cup, even Six Nations in a few years' time.
Yeah, because I know you were banking on Italy doing really well in the last World Cup, weren't you? And upsetting the odds and beating New Zealand. another typically poor flow rugby shout.
I said that Italy might beat France, and lo and behold, they should have done.
They drew.
They got robbed, I think. French players charging down, having a war to carry on a pitch, taking a leaf out of the South African book. Well, I think on a more important, maybe serious note, you might say, especially with Lewis Leiner, I think there are a few accusations of maybe Italy nicking him from the England setup, even though he is half Italian, he was born in Italy. I think, I don't know if you saw on social media, Van der Merwe got quite a bit of like friendly abuse for being South African, not being really Scottish.
I think the gentleman who wrote it for the Telegraph.
Yeah, for the Telegraph. And there was one about Bundiaki as well, not being Irish.
James Lowe.
Yeah. How do you feel about that? Do you think, have you got any personal opinions on players changing?
It does just feel like a bit of a rehashed debate. Do you know what I mean? I think it's. I also saw a lot of coverage on how it's quite interesting that that article was written in the Telegraph. You know, a few days after Van der Merwe absolutely destroys England.
Or like Alec Hepburn, for example, England.
Yeah, but I feel like you know players like. I don't know, it's a bit daft. It's such a big debate. I think every country has players that aren't necessarily born in that country. You look at England, I know he's got he does have it might be his grandparents, but you look at Ethan Roots,
yeah,
say, you know, you could very easily make a claim about him not particularly being English if you really wanted to. Do you know what I mean? So I do get it, but I just kind of think it's such an old conversation. It's quite boring, and I think countries are gradually moving away from that. Do you know what I mean? It's not as if Van der Merwe has just turned up on the scene. He's been playing for Scotland for donkeys now. Same with Bundiaki for Ireland. So it doesn't make too much sense to me. So moving on.
One last thing on Van der Merwe. I don't know if you've seen, but he's one try away from
becoming Scotland's all time try scorer.
Was it 26 he's on? Stuart Hogg was on 27.
Stuart Hogg was on 27.
Yeah.
Yeah, Stuart Hogg. Cool. It's been eventful few weeks. But enough about that.
In the news recently, wasn't he?
Enough about that. We don't want to get legal trouble.
Defamation.
But yeah, he was. Yeah, interesting few weeks, Stuart Hogg. But finishing off that Six Nations, I suppose, team the first three rounds, I think Cameron Winnetts looked really good at fullback for Wales. I mean, obviously Hugo Keenan would have taken that title if he hadn't been injured most recently against Wales. Be interesting to see you sticking on the fullback theme, whether. You know, fullbacks are going to be crucial next few weeks looking ahead. I mean, England, do they keep with Furbank? Do they go back to Stewart? France, Thomas Ramos is probably going to have to step up into 10 for France, seeing that Jalibert's out and joins Ntamack on the sidelines.
Donty's also out, isn't he?
Donty's out.
5 weeks,
but
possibly.
Sticking on the theme of 15s, do Italy keep... Do you know? Do they go back and put Tommaso Allan in and move Capuozzo off to the wing? Because we saw, especially at the end of that French game, Tommaso Allan would usually be on the kicking duties ahead of Garbisi.
Yeah.
And you've got to think Allan slots that 3 points to defeat France in a famous victory for the Italians. So theme of fullbacks is going to be quite important, I think, over the next few weeks.
Where do you see the last games of Six Nations going? Do you think Ireland, England...
I think Ireland are going to struggle against England.
Really?
Yeah. Going to Twickenham, I think it's always been a bit of a bogey task for Ireland. I think they will come out of that on the right side of the scoreline, but I think that will be a lot closer than people think, and England will obviously be looking for a reaction, especially at home. And when you've got Rag and Bowman playing at half time, like England just announced, God, they're going to be pumped up. that was quite great. But then sticking on Ireland, I think you'd expect them to beat Scotland at home. Scotland obviously have Italy up next. Expect them to beat Italy, but Scotland always make a hash of it against Italy. So I think that could be a similar storyline to the Ireland England game. I think they'll be, both those games will be, you know, 7 to 10 point victories for either side, not too comfortable. And then Wales face the daunting task of hosting France, don't they?
Yeah, but I suppose you almost, this is perfect time for Wales to almost play France, with France losing so many of their best players. It's going to be quite a weakened side, probably who haven't played much rugby together. Who do you think, who's going to play fullback if Ramos goes to 10? Who's going to start in the centres? Fiku, Mufana. Like, Mufana hasn't really played that well when he's been given the opportunity, I don't think. And their pack, well, Wales could maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I think at the Principality as well, that'd be a great game. And I mean, a huge game now, you'd have to say, for Fabien Galthié as well, yeah. You know? I know, obviously,
French Federation came out, though, to say
that, you know, they're backing him, but you lose to Wales, and then you head into a final weekend. You know, I don't think they'll lose to Wales, but there's, you know, there's a chance.
You didn't think Italy were going to draw to him, so...
No, I didn't. I certainly didn't, Florian. You look at you know, France welcoming England, who are going to be up for sending a message as well. I don't know. I think that could be a tough 2 weeks for Galtier. I wouldn't be too comfortable if I were him. And finally, before we move off Six Nations and French rugby, cool, they're missing Dupont, aren't they? He's tearing it up in the
sevens
over in Los Angeles. At the time of recording, France are in the Cup semi-final where Ireland await for them, and then brilliant to see Team GB in the semi-finals against
Spain. I think their first semi-finals.
I think you're right. So GB have a very good chance of getting
Spain beat Fiji, I believe.
Spain beating Fiji, brilliant stuff from Ufla. And obviously Dupont just running riot over in LA, and I think the French will really be missing him. But before we go, Flo, let's, as ever, address just what objectively is the funnest competition in the world, Super Rugby Pacifica. Obviously, having their big 3-day event in Melbourne.
So
every game this weekend has been played in the Australian city. Where do you want to start off with there, Flo?
I think, looking at scores overall, I don't know if you've heard, but there seems to be a common theme, especially every year, down south, in Southern Hemisphere.
Down south.
That they just hate defence, and they just love attack. And I think looking at these results, these scores in particular, you've got, Rebels 48, Western Force 34, Minor Pacifica 39, Fiji and Drift 36. They just love all-out attack, don't they? Do you have any highlights you want to pick out?
Yeah, I mean, quickly before I do, shout out to all those, because I know we've got a few very loyal listeners that might not have rugby as their first sport or might not know too much about the game. If you want a fun way to learn about the sport of rugby, go on YouTube and watch the highlights each week from Super Rugby Pacific. Yeah. They're only 5 minutes long, and some of the rugby they are playing is just absolutely wonderful. Some of the football, as they would call it.
Footy.
Yeah, great footy, Mike. Absolutely brilliant. I suppose, for me, the biggest result of that weekend was the Tars.
Yeah.
Their big victory over Crusaders, running out 37-24 winners. I mean, massive questions for the Crusaders now. I know we're only, two games into Super Rugby, but that's their worst start in Super Rugby since 2014. And obviously they're struggling without Scott Robertson,
who's
obviously now become the All Blacks coach. Such a short competition. They need to start, only 2 games in, but you know, you'd be expecting them now to start to try and kick on and actually get some victories. And I just thought there was a wonderful irony that the current Crusaders coach, Rob Penny, used to be the coach of the Waratahs, was sacked in 2021 after the Waratahs had a winless season. He goes back to Australia with the Crusaders to face the Tars, and the Crusaders are humiliated. So there's some irony there. It really needs to start kicking on. But I think it's good for the tournament, because normally we would just see Crusaders just absolutely steamrolling everyone. Yeah. But obviously, as we've said, missing out on Scott Robertson, you know, a number of players as well. Mwanga obviously going to Japan, yeah. Sam Whitelock playing his trade in France.
Will Jordan out
for the season. You're right. Severis is certainly, you know, playing some good stuff, but you can't only do it with one player. So I suppose that was a big takeaway from the weekend. But the most exciting game has to have been the corker that we saw this morning in UK time between Hurricanes and the Reds.
Yeah, went to Golden Point, didn't it?
Going to Golden Point, Jordy Barrett, the All Blacks 12, being sent off for a high shot. I know that they're becoming quite normal, I suppose, to see
a card each game.
I do still think it's going to get you a red these days. The challenge that the tackle that was made, but you know, it's quite a passive hit. I think you've got Jordan Pataia, huge Australian fella running into you.
I'm a big fan of Pataia.
Pataia's brilliant, but he's running into you, and you know, Barrett, I just don't think that's a red card. But anyway, the Canes weren't made to suffer too much in the end, and shout out to the 15, Ruben Love, who was absolutely brilliant. My flatmate T McD, shout out to T McD. He was absolutely loving Ruben Love. So yeah, I think he's one to watch and will definitely be amongst the All Blacks squad that Scott Robertson will pick in July for those summer tests against England.
I think on that Golden Point note, how do you feel it would work if it kind of migrated over to the Premiership? Do you think that would be quite a good way? Because at the moment they get points for a draw, the game's just done. But do you think, because it's such a shorter competition over in Super Rugby, that it actually works better? Or do you think it could be something which could be incorporated into the Gallagher Premiership?
No, that's a brilliant question. I think it would work perfectly in the Premiership, and it links back to what we were saying earlier, doesn't it, where the focus on rugby in the Southern Hemisphere is to attack.
Yeah.
And I mean, that rule specifically where you just don't want to have a draw kind of proves that. And what I loved about that whole kind of extra time period, I suppose, where both teams were going for that golden point, is that I feel like if we did see that in the Premiership, you'd probably end up with the majority of sides looking at your beloved Exeter, maybe, you know, kind of playing out, waiting for a penalty to draw the three and being quite conservative, I suppose, and focusing on defence. Both those teams in extra time, even with Hurricanes down to 14 men, wanted to try to win the game.
I think almost to be best in the European Championships, especially in those pool stages. Mm. I think that would be quite an interesting way of, because it, like, don't get me started on it, but you get so many teams progressing through to the actual knockouts, you get the same results. I just think it'd be quite an interesting way of making the pool stages slightly more exciting and giving more teams kind of more points.
And then to just quickly summarise the other results, obviously, that we had over the weekend in Super Rugby Pacifica, butt in, Flo, when if you feel there's anything important to say on any of these. The Highlanders coming up short against the Blues, losing 29-37. But Rhys Patchell, former Welsh international, looking absolutely brilliant pulling the strings for the Highlanders. And I'm sure that Warren Gatland is keeping tabs on him, because it seems crazy when, you know, Wales don't have an out and out. Well, they have an out and out 10 in Sam Costello, and Ewan Lloyd's recently converted to that position. But both very young, and you've got Patchell playing some of the best rugby it seems he's ever played, all the way over in New Zealand. Rebels 48-34 winners against the Force. We commented on that last week, but the Force really struggling despite making some of those big summer signings, Ben White, Ben Donaldson, etc. Moana Pacifica just about getting past the Fijian Druid. That was some comeback attempt though by the Fijian Druid. Moana Pacifica winning 39-36, brilliant game. Chiefs led by D-Mac, Damien McKenzie, 46-12 winners against the Brumbies, but Corey O'Toole scoring 2 tries to the Brumbies, former Aussie sevens player, he's looking absolutely brilliant, and I would be very surprised if he doesn't get a start for the Aussies in their summer test against Wales. And that's all the game. So unless you've got any last points you'd like to make,
parting words,
any parting words, any words of advice, Flo?
No, I don't think so this week. I'm just looking forward to return with Six Nations.
Yes, well, we're both very excited for that, and I suppose that ends our second episode.
Yeah.
The Wilco and Off Show. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much to everyone for listening. Please do get in touch with us on Instagram at Wilco and Hoff. If you would like to, you know, we'd love
pop
any questions in. As we said last week, what guests would you like to hear? But don't take the mic and kind of say Bowden Barrett. And let us know what you think, because ultimately we love doing this, but we would love to improve. So please do let us know how we can do that. Thank you very much to everyone for listening, and have a brilliant week.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.